Welcome to my podcast.
Yeah, thank you. I'm happy we're here.
Me too.
Yeah. I feel the the urge to just kind of call in. Kichimantu, gawin o aski, niwa komaganak, nikomanak, nimushomanak. I want to call in the great spirits of all the directions. Call in the energy and the support and the guidance of all of our relatives, our grandmothers and grandfathers, our families. Call in the energy and the support of the four-legged beings, of the turtle, of the winged ones, the eagle, of the wolf, the bear, the bison. Call in the support of the swimming ones, the fish, the gold, the salmon fish. Call in the support of the mineral and rock beings, of the plant and medicine beings, the roots, the trees. Call in the energy of water, nibi, the rivers and lakes, water from the sky, the snow, the ice, the rain, the oceans, waters of the trees and of the springs and the mountains. Call in the energy of Ishkoteo, of the fire in our bodies, in our hearts, the fire that helps us to light our paths, the fire that keeps us warm in the winter. Call in the energy of sky, of the wind and the clouds, of the breath in our bodies, in our bellies. And call in the energy of Sagituin, love, care, Wagutuin, of kinship, of Kichi Manitu, of Great Creator, of Kakawi no Aski, of the Earth Mother, Niwakumagnak, Kananaskomten Miupi Matsuin. Thank you to this good life. And it's a pleasure to be here. Hi, hi.
Wow, what a way to start it off. Leave it to Mo. Well, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure.
A little bit first, and
yeah,
then...
Sure. Okay. Yeah. Tansei, Nitsige San Mo Clark, Ekwa Negamo Pesai Oskoyo, Nitotse no Tosko Nek, Magani Wigan, Hachochage, Nia Oma Otepemsu, Aptagosisan, Michif, Nehyo, Munyao, French, Norwegian, British. I'm an artist, a performer, singer, songwriter, educator, community worker and teacher, and the middle child of three daughters. And I'm Métis, Cree, and mixed ancestry, living in Jojage in Montreal. And I'm excited to interview you today.
Thank you.
So perhaps you can introduce yourself.
Sure.
As well.
Well, I ain't gonna lie. I'm nervous. This is my interview. I'm starting this whole thing off with myself. So, yeah, my name is Mel Lefebvre. And, well, let's see. The really super easy part is my mom is Irish. So my dad's side is a little bit more complicated. So he's Métis, Nehiyo, Nakota, Soto, and French. And his mom and her family came from, well, actually she was born in Quebec, but her family came here in the early 1900s from Manitoba to work at the paper mill in the Eastern Townships. So, I don't know, they had a farm there. I'm not really sure why they left. I don't know, I guess just for the job, I suppose. So I'm a graduate student at Concordia University. I'm a researcher, a writer, interdisciplinary artist. So I don't know, a lot of stuff.
Beautiful
drawing, painting, jewelry, fibers. I don't know. It's just so much to mess around with, you know, filmmaking, all kinds of stuff. I do lots of work with the Native Women's Shelter.
And you're a mom.
And I'm a mom. Oh my God. Jesus.
And so you grew up in Quebec?
I was born in Windsor. So that's Windsor, Ontario is Atawandaron, Anishinaabeg, and Haudenosaunee territory.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's Windsor, Ontario. My parents met somewhere around there and decided to go there for some weird reason.
Right.
It's such a weird border town. It's
Windsor at all.
It's bizarre.
Yeah.
It's really bizarre. It just feels like a sort of like a pit stop.
Isn't Windsor like one of the places where they do a lot of like machine like factories?
Yeah, so across the river in Detroit, which is the Motor City, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But then you also have like the big three in Windsor too. So so that was, I think, the big driving force of Windsor is the auto industry. But we got out of there and lived on Mi'kmaq territory, PEI.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, for like 11 years. Yeah.
Okay, for 11 years.
Yeah, well, till I was 11, so probably like 10 years or, you know, 9.5 years, something like that. So that's where my mom's from. She's like, she grew up on a farm. She's like one of 9 kids.
Wow.
Yeah, they had a big, big family. Lived on a potato farm. Farm potatoes had animals, like the whole 9 yards.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like a, you know, dysfunctional kind of Irish family.
Yep.
Everyone knows that story.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Especially on the East Coast.
That's it. Bye.
It's like, yeah.
Oh my gosh. So.
And so did you grow up in Charlottetown or did you grow up more farm?
Just outside of Charlottetown.
Okay.
And it was good. Like it was just such a nice place to be. You could leave your door unlocked. Like it was at that time. It was just such a beautiful place. Like, and the beach is, of course, amazing. We grew up on the beach. So.
Mm. So you're a bit of a saltwater girl then.
Oh yeah. That's definitely one of the places like I feel like at home. Completely at ease, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Montreal too, but it's just like a different vibe, obviously. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so we moved here when I was 11 because my dad was born in Coaticook.
Here being Jojaga, being Montreal.
Yeah, we moved back. That was just such a fucked up time. Like, we didn't know French. My dad wasn't like a huge communicator, so he never spoke to us in French.
But your dad speaks French?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, he spent his life being disconnected from any kind of indigenous identity.
But the move to come back was that he wanted to kind of
I think it was work.
No. Or,
okay. No, he doesn't really like Montreal, to be honest. I think it holds too many probably memories, bad memories.
Right.
But
and so you say, like, your dad, he's quite, like, mixed, like, indigenous, and your mom, Irish.
Yep.
So in terms of then, like, your upbringing.
Yeah, we grew up, like, Irish.
Right.
I mean, we've always known that my dad is native, but he was disconnected from that. So he didn't have any teachings to pass on. And my mom did. Like, she was very connected. She's Catholic. We grew up Catholic, went to church. I've got one sister, Lisa, and she's awesome. We were like we've always been like super tight.
Mm-hmm.
Super tight. Yeah, we grew up in an alcoholic family, and that alcoholism kind of runs through our families on both sides. So we were, as two kids growing up with that, we were just like super tight. Yeah.
So she's kind of like, she was like a safety for you.
Yeah, I mean, like when in teenage years, we were pretty much like, we hated each other, but, you know, you always...
What sisters don't go through that,
right,
though?
Exactly. But you can always count on each other.
Yeah.
She was, a safety net for sure. Yeah. So we didn't grow up with any teachings. It's really only when my grandmother started getting, like, dementia, like she was kind of slowly slipping into that kind of severe dementia that I was kind of like asking her questions and kind of.
And how old were you when this started happening?
Oh, I was probably like 30 or something.
Okay.
But the funny story was like she would say, I'd ask her, like, what nation are we from or whatever? And she'd be like, and her first language was French. So it was kind of hard. She didn't speak much English. So it was already hard for us to communicate. But then, to top that off with a bit of dementia. So she was saying, you know, Blackfoot. And then she was saying, like, you know, Cree, and then she was saying, you know, like, so just all, like, and tons of different nations which made no sense to me. I was just like, oh my God, she's like losing it.
Right.
But in actuality, she was describing these kinship relationships that we had going, like that somehow still remained in her that she could kind of tell us about that. So, and I only realized that much later, you know, and it was just like, my God, she was like trying to tell us.
Well, and specifically that, as like Plains, more so Plains people, right?
For sure.
You said like Manitoba. And so
yeah.
a lot of those like migratory routes and like kind of bison people like we're coming together and occupying the same territories yeah. in different moments throughout
yeah.
the year.
Trading, creating yeah. together, being in community together. Yeah, mm-hmm. totally. And all her brothers and sisters identified as Cree.
Okay.
So, and, you know, they lived right next to what's now Piegwa's First Nation. Just that story is so mm-hmm. fascinating to me mm-hmm. later and now that she's gone, you know, mm-hmm. but.
So you were able yeah. to talk with her about that for a little bit, I guess?
A bit, but not really. Like, she was quite disconnected. She was the youngest of her family and she was the only one that was born here. And her mom died when she was quite young. And, she married, well, my grandfather, but he's a Quebecer and he's, well, kind of an asshole, to put it mildly, you know, mm-hmm. kind of womanizer and things like mm-hmm. that. So right. I think that just her mode was survival and just, you know, bringing up the kids as best she knew how within this really, you know, state of crisis that lasted her whole life.
Right.
And so my dad and his siblings, they all experienced that and were very disconnected from each other, but also from their parents. It was just like a real, mm-hmm. yeah, kind of a...
But I think that's a story that lots of people share,
totally.
Right? And specifically
oh, yeah.
women of that time.
Yeah.
Like, how much of life was based on survival?
Yeah.
And what did that mean in yeah. terms of, like, trying to raise children within a constantly shifting, changing system
yeah.
and marrying a non-Indigenous man and
yeah.
kind of that separation and that sort of fracturing that
yeah.
that went on.
Yeah, yeah, that so that was kind of crazy. So already she was disconnected. So then to try to kind of find stories with her, you know, any kind of teachings, it was really,
mm-hmm.
I mean, she was just, she was always wearing her moccasins and like, you know, she gave me this beaded medallion that she'd always had. Mm-hmm. And so there were things that yeah. she was connected to, but she didn't necessarily have the teachings.
So then in yeah. your own process and practice, then how did you start to gain some of those teachings or access that? Like, was it through community mm-hmm. or through
all
school?
All of those things,
or?
Like I just kind of started sort of feeling my way around doing research and a lot of it online at the library, talking to people, that kind of stuff. But then you realize, okay, there's one real fundamental in connecting to your indigeneity, which is like connecting to your community. Like you need mm-hmm. to find those relations. Mm-hmm. And so I did, like literally my own connections, my own family,
mm-hmm.
connecting to cousins, connecting to, you know, people just mm-hmm. that I never knew. And then also finding community here in Montreal, the Métis crew here, you know, this like just tons of support. And a lot of those people I met through school, mm-hmm. through Concordia. Then also just being at the shelter and volunteering there. And then, yeah, that kind of grew into doing more community building for them, representing them whenever I would go out to just build new relationships, you know,
mm-hmm.
for the shelter.
Could you describe what some of the community building for the shelter mm-hmm. has been for you?
Yeah, like at first I started there, I was a cook on the weekends, which was great. Like I love cooking and I love that. It was just, there's so many nice people to meet there. And then that turned into like finding some traditional meats because you know they run on a budget.
Mm-hmm.
They're usually only getting specific kinds of meat and specific cuts, and so there's not a lot of traditional food there. And you know, of course, like everybody just wants to feel like they're at home.
Yep.
in a state of crisis especially. So yeah, I would kind of source like some traditional meats from different hunters like in Ganawage, and then also just trying to approach different companies for
like sponsorship or like
kind of, but not quite so formal. Just
right.
like, do you have an extra like box of meat that you right. want to get rid of? Because mm-hmm. we need some, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So sort of like more appealing to like the human beings that actually work in these places, you know, and just to kind of make them realize what kind of privilege they have. And then that kind of grew into like working more with Marty Miller, the clinical coordinator, and Nagusset, obviously the executive director. And we did like the Indigenous library at the shelter, which was cool. Contacting publishers, and people are super generous when you mm-hmm. ask them.
Donating books that are like Indigenous
yeah.
authors or subjects that are a little bit more relevant to the women.
Yeah, yeah, but especially like just fiction. Like who in crisis, who's seriously living all these things, wants to like read about residential schools? Like mm-hmm. you don't always want that. You want to mm-hmm. read fucking Twilight mm-hmm. and Harry Potter. Like mm-hmm. fuck off into some magical land,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
So developing just some new titles, you know, just not even Indigenous, but like, and then kind of tapping into like all those authors that I know, or awesome. You know, through Twitter and things like that. So that was super cool.
And that's extended beyond the shelter too, right?
Because
you've also been mobilizing libraries in other sites.
Yeah, we're trying to, well, we actually just met with LeClaire Prison, which is a provincial prison, and they have a lot of Indigenous women incarcerated there.
Right.
So we're trying to, well, I mean, we got the acceptance, so we're basically going to start ordering books for them.
Great.
And then we're trying to do the same thing at the federal prison, but there's a lot more policy legislation we have to kind of deal with. We're trying to get some post-secondary education in there too. And that's right. also in solidarity with like the Black community here. So we're trying not to just focus on the Indigenous incarcerated folks, but like everybody that's there, like just bring post-secondary in so that once they come out, they have something that they can lean on, you know?
Right. Yeah, for sure.
So yeah, that's another initiative. And I do basically represent the shelter when I go and do those things, and I'm on the board at the shelter. So yeah, now we're working on fucking burning the child welfare system down.
Yeah.
Which is slow going, but.
Yeah. You gotta start somewhere.
You need to have a really big box of matches for that shit, you know?
Lots of smudge as well.
Oh, fuck.
Find a balance. So this is all like in, like, I guess related to like the work that you're doing for community and with community, in particular, like with a focus on supporting and like making space for Indigenous women.
Yeah.
And so I guess my question for you then, how do you bring, you know, some of that energy into your own practice and into your own work? Like when you're not supporting others, what does like the creative Mel, like what is that? How does that function?
All of that other work can be quite cerebral. I do a lot of writing for that kind of work too. That's good, but then I have to kind of turn that off. So the art kind of lets me do that, even though I'm kind of dealing, communicating, sort of exploring the same topics, let's say. I can just do it in a more conceptual way, or maybe less cerebral or less connected to that, those kinds of emotions
or physical. Yeah, right.
Yeah. So like filmmaking, I can be super conceptual with that, just like exploring images and ideas and working with materials, working with my hands a lot, exploring different fabrics, or like sewing. I don't bead. I haven't done that yet.
Right. You've been working a lot with like animal fur.
Yeah, animal fur. Yeah, hide and things like that. I've been making a lot of jewelry lately. It's kind of hard for me to stay in one medium, which kind of, it's not really a problem until you kind of have to put everything somewhere.
Yeah,
like quite literally, where do I find the space to put all this fucking shit? So that's what I'm grappling with. Well, I've always kind of grappled with it, but less so when I was doing like digital art, because for obvious reasons, it's just, it's perfect, right? This tiny hard drive. But now it's really kind of exploding.
And you've got a beautiful art room and space.
My family tends to, you know, comment, and that helps me edit things down. Like, when are you ever going to fucking use that shit?
Right.
Like, get rid of it.
Right.
Yeah, they help with my editing process.
Could you describe like one of your projects or one of your pieces that you really enjoyed creating, and you know, what about it, or something that maybe was transformative?
Well, probably that last film that I made that you generously kind of donated your music to, which was just fucking fantastic. I mean, before your music came, I was kind of dealing with that. Some really funny kind of sounds.
This is creative
kinship.
Like,
I can do this? Yeah. Yeah, I can make music? No, you can't.
Yeah.
Anyways, so I always like to do things on my own. I don't like to seek out help, which is, I don't know. It's just my tendency.
It's societal.
I know. It takes too much time to get someone involved. I might have to pay them. Right. I don't have any money.
Yeah.
I just want to explore my own ideas.
Yeah.
Because then that other side of me that's quite cerebral and, you know, out in the world doing all that building, I do have to like take everyone's stuff into consideration, which is great. But when it's, you know, me time and that kind of creative time, it's just like, no, I don't even want to hear anyone's voice. Like, just don't come near me.
Well, in a way, it's like you could consider that like selfish, or you can consider it like self-caring.
Oh my
God. Like, at what point can we actually just like turn the ideas inward and like really like create from that place of like, what is my intuition and what is my instinct kind of want to put out in the world?
Yeah, I feel like sometimes I don't even want to think about what am I putting out there. I just want to do it. I just want to do it. And like just all the things I make don't go anywhere.
Maybe Although that video did go to Imaginative.
Yeah. Right? Like a lot of just, I mean, the stuff has been in shows and like different galleries and stuff like that. But then it just comes back here and fills up my basement and that's fine with me. Like I don't need to, I'm lucky enough that I don't need to focus on it for money or things like that because I find that can be really distracting. Yeah. I've had to do that with my writing.
Yes.
And I never got to be that short story writer I wanted to be.
Right.
Because it doesn't make any money. And I had to build my career, my first career, on working for, you know, capitalist coins, basically. Right. And that sucks the life out of you.
For sure.
Now back to that film, which was really great. I mean, it was just me kind of fucking around, you know, filming myself naked, balled up on the floor, on my favorite comforter. Yeah. And then back to the bed, my favorite spot. Integrating, of course, like Anne's images there because she's like my true love of my entire... Anne is my daughter. I have two daughters. One is my stepdaughter, who is also absolutely wonderful. But Anne actually came out of my vagina, and so I have a very particular attachment to her. And so I usually kind of like integrate her into the films that I make somehow, which she really enjoys. Yeah, that film was really cool. It just kind of let me explore images and kind of deal with some of the things that were going on at the time, which was around like the pipeline and Trudeau buying the pipeline. That was a fucked up year. You know, there were...
I don't remember which year hasn't been.
Well,
that was specific to this...
Trans Mountain Pipeline. And Wet'suwet'en, the MMIWG2S inquiry, and there were a few deaths at that time that got a lot of coverage, and it's just, oh god, it was just really fucked up. So that kind of helped me kind of deal with some of those feelings.
As a source of, I guess, transformation or even healing.
Yeah.
To be able to kind of process through, definitely, like, manipulating images.
Yeah. Yeah, and then the music, and also kind of integrating some of the stuff I film when I go outside for walks and things like that. Like, it was great. And then it went to Imaginative, which was awesome. And I got to go. And even though it played at the wrong speed, I was so hurt. And when I apologized to the crowd, everyone was like, "We didn't notice anything." I'm like, "What?" Mo's music was like seriously satanic. It was so slow. It was so, I'm so glad you weren't there. Because I was mortified, but it was a cool process. And so now I'm working on something else or trying to find time to work on.
Amazing.
But yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. It's cool. I like my basement. I like my desk and my area where I make things. And then, yeah. Next, that's like second to my bed. My bed is the favorite space.
I often think about it. It's like sites or like territories for self-care, you know, and it's like, those sites as like a way to reclaim those relationships with our bodies, with our spirits, with like our own prayers, with our sensual, you know, kind of abundant, generous, regenerative kind of nature. Yeah. And sometimes that happens through the doing, through like the artwork and the creation. And sometimes that just happens through the being. And I think too, because we're so often in the doing, that it's like, when do we allow or have time and space just to be?
It's so rare. Because even when I'm being, you know, my mind is still going. I mean, like anybody else, it's hard to shut your mind off.
We're kind of talking about it in other ways, but what is your concept of decolonization?
I've come to sort of hate that word. I hate it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think a lot of people feel like that.
Like, what word would you want to use to replace it?
Like, today I used in this meeting that we had on child welfare, I was thinking about reform, which is such a, like, political weird word.
I know. It makes me think of the conservative
part. Yes! I know! And I was like, that's the wrong word. I'm like, just, I don't know, but it's really lost its soul.
Well, I think because in some ways it points to colonization. And it's always like we're trying to undo something instead of what are we actually trying to build or what are we trying to like create or cultivate, you know?
Cultivate and build outside of that thing. Sort of like conceptualizing a new form, existence. You're working inside the institution, but you're imagining something that's outside of it.
Right.
that's actually been existing. It exists. Mm-hmm. We do exist outside of that.
Mm-hmm.
Our ancestors exist outside of it. Our ways of being and knowing have always existed outside mm-hmm. of that. So mm-hmm. we're not, you know, trapped in there. And I get that, oh, well, you know, you're so anti-capitalist, anti-patriarchy, but you're working in academia. It's like, okay, well, I need a fucking job. I need to feed my family. It's not perfect, but you have to do something.
Yeah.
It's better than just sitting back and criticizing and doing nothing. Perfect example is the child welfare system. There are people in there that are hurting and it needs to be reformed. It's like immediate reforms.
Mm-hmm.
This is the only thing that you can do mm-hmm. today. Mm-hmm. And so you have to go in there and kind of chip away at it, right? So like decolonization, I'm not really sure. I'm working on a new concept. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's like a Cree word. I don't know.
Yeah. And you do mention some of those Cree teachings, some of those kind of core principles.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I do feel like Wagotoin exists outside of that.
And Wagotoin is the Cree concept for like kinship
mm-hmm.
and notions of community and togetherness outside of just like our immediate relations.
Right, exactly.
And encompassing like land and animals and
respect and reciprocity and accountability and all that.
Kinship plays a huge role. Thinking about, you know, if we're stepping outside of this notion of decolonizing, it's like, well, what are we cultivating? And who are the support systems that help us cultivate that space? And so I guess that's my next question.
Fred is my partner and he's like my best friend. He's also my husband. We're married. I identify as queer. Like, I've never really labeled myself. I've always been that. But when I was growing up, I didn't really hear that. It's like gay was really the word when I was growing up, like in the 80s. But it wasn't queer. And queer, queer was actually, queer was like it was like an insult. Yeah, it was like an insult.
Not really a good word. And so it's kind of coming back now.
Right.
I definitely think it's of a particular generation.
I do too. But I feel comfortable with it because I'm not a lesbian. I am bisexual, but that just feels like a really dated word or something. It's weird.
I guess it also sort of designates that there are only two.
There's only two, exactly.
And there's like only two roots, and like it's only this like gender binary.
Exactly.
Kind of construct.
Exactly.
Like, queerness to me, I think it's just, it's more encompassing, more inclusive in a way.
Absolutely. And I'm also, like, as since I've had Anne, she's seven now, my sexuality has changed a lot. Like, I tend most of the time to feel quite asexual.
Mm.
So it's all just sort of like this fluid thing that's been happening.
Right.
And, but Fred is very, very supportive. And I have two very close friends, Christina and Sarah, who accept me no matter what for who I am.
Brilliant.
Yeah, they listen to me. They just listen to all my crap. And then we laugh together and mm-hmm. it's perfect. Who else is there? There's someone at my parents. Fuck, I almost forgot my parents. They're always super supportive and they're always really proud of me, which is nice. And I think that all of this reconnecting work that I've done has helped my dad and I kind of get closer and helped him too to have some knowledge of who he is, I think, mm-hmm. right? So I think he's appreciated that.
That's it. Yeah. I mean, I often think about that process because is your sister as involved in kind of reconnecting and exploring ancestry and indigeneity and who that and what that means for you?
No, she's not really, and that's okay. I mean, she's exploring it very slowly.
So
sometimes
that,
we talk about it.
Yeah.
It can be a little odd, I guess, you know, like, because that's my whole life, you know, that's who I am. And when you think about your own sibling, it's like you would expect that they would feel the same way, but when they don't,
and like be there with you.
But I think a lot of people that I know have gone through this.
I feel like that's like part of the strangeness and the beauty and the kind of the uniqueness of like who we end up finding as our like chosen kin, specifically as like Métis and like mixed folks.
Yeah.
Well, and anybody, it's like when you kind of start to retrace those roots and those lineages and do that exploring, it's like you're either in or you're not.
No,
and
I know.
So, you know, I think it's beautiful though when exploring and doing that work can actually bring you closer
mm-hmm.
in relationship with family, because I've also seen it kind of go the opposite way.
Yeah.
And create tension and kind of divide.
Oh, it's created tension
even hostility,
for sure.
Yeah. Where it's like, why are you leaving us? Why are you abandoning us? Like, that's not who we are.
Yeah.
And yet,
it can be quite threatening to people. And I think my sister has felt that sometimes, like that I'm erasing or negating somehow my mother's you know, heritage, right? Right. But to me, it's like I've always been Irish and we grew up that way. And now for me, it's time for something else. And it's
to
time
to find a balance.
Yeah.
Right.
But, you know, I understand because a lot of the things I teach Anne are not about being Irish. They're about being an Indigenous person, you know?
Yeah.
And so that can rub people the wrong way sometimes. Yeah.
But I think it's also still, I mean, it's important and it's figuring out that balance as you go.
Yeah.
You know, but also like living in a city, you know, buying your groceries at the grocery store and, you know, all of these things. It's like, we're so absorbed and absolved in so many ways in like a primarily white dominant culture that it's like, we have to find access and we have to be able to kind of constantly return to the, you know, a more Indigenous frame. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that requires more energy because the rest is in a lot of ways like second nature.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it's so accessible.
Yeah.
It really requires a lot of effort.
Yeah.
When you're an urban Indigenous person to connect.
How do you care for yourself?
Mm-hmm.
And as an extension to that, what do you think are the biggest barriers to self-care?
I've been riding my bike through the winter this year.
Right on. That's badass.
Fuck. Yeah. It's been pretty awesome to know that I can do that.
Yeah.
Is your neck hurting?
A little bit.
Okay. I know.
We're laying scrunched. In bed and I'm kind of like in an awkward position.
Did we say that we're laying in bed?
No, I don't think we
did. Oh, we are.
I just did.
Okay.
Just adjust.
Kind of
like, you know.
I know.
It's like pillow talk, basically. Pillow talk can get a little bit tiring on the neck sometimes.
Yeah, I should have had more pillows, but it's pretty pillowy.
It's pretty pillowy.
I like Netflix is like my friend. Mm-hmm. One of my best friends. I forgot to mention that. It's my support system, Netflix.
Yeah.
And I love like, it's, yeah, I'm just, I love horror and true crime.
Awesome.
All things dark and scary.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, it's another way, I think in a way it's like watching the horror, watching the crime. It's like kind of another way to negotiate or navigate fear.
Yeah.
But in like the comfort of your own home.
Right. I can turn it off whenever I want.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is usually I'm like binging something.
Right. I was like, and how is it for you to turn off Netflix? Like what is that process? Doesn't happen.
It's on right now. That's hard for me to turn off Netflix if I'm into something.
Yeah.
And that really drives Fred crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's not a TV person. We don't even have a TV. And so usually it's just me on my phone getting all like zoned out and weird. We have like a yard. So we do some gardening, vegetable gardening and flowers and stuff. That helps a lot. I like essential oils.
Oh,
lavender.
Essential oils too.
Yeah, lavender's one of my favorites. That calms me down.
Yeah.
Oh, and my antidepressants, of course, calm me down as well.
It's always positive.
You know, every so often I go off them to see what's my baseline, like how am I doing? Because I started taking them after I had Anne, had postpartum. I'm still postpartum. I think I'm always going to be postpartum, just postpartum.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so the last time I went off them, it was a full crash and burn. So it's like, no.
Okay.
No, going back, my brain chemistry is not happening for whatever reason. It's no big deal.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, I think it's a sign of the time though too.
Oh my god,
there's so much going on, and anyone who's like even remotely sensitive to what's happening and who has like also like a family history of just like kind of instability in the brain chemistry, it's a lot to
and make. There is that in my family too, so
mine too.
I just kind of accept it and take the pills and
I think, and it's good that it's identified and that like you're actually taking those steps to like support yourself and to like bring the baseline up.
A lot of people don't
want
to do it, you know, but I mean, I really did try, and I think it's good to try everything else before you actually take anything. Exercise, eat well if you can, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I did all that, didn't work. So taking the pills,
Those are all good ways to care for yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things that you had actually written about was thinking about your ancestors.
Did I say that?
Yeah, you did.
Oh, what about them?
Well, you sort of said something about like thinking about your ancestors as like a way to kind of take care of yourself. Could you describe if you have like a practice for kind of coming into relationship with them, or how do you think about them, or...
I don't, like, I'm not really a good, like, routine person. So if I'm, like, smudging, which is not daily because I don't do anything daily except take my pill and brush my teeth.
Right.
And
feed yourself.
And feed myself. Like, there's, I'm just not good with that. Can you keep a journal?
Oh, no. I go through phases and then I'm
I have, like, 100 journals with like two pages done.
Yeah, me too. And
it's so like proud of myself.
Writing, yeah. Perfect first couple pages and then it just gets scattered.
So looking forward to this journal journey I'm starting. Like the artist's way. Have you ever done that shit?
I think I did 1 week. Or maybe like a day.
Like, please, the artist's way.
I need like 15 minutes. Like, I can do 15 minute spurts of things. Like, even this 21 day abundance. I like made it to scary. 20 days, Ooh. But it took me like 30 days to.
But if I do get to smudging, it really does help me kind of become centered. And I do feel that things kind of happen in a good way after that. Like, for example, we smudged before this podcast, and I haven't had any issues. Like, I haven't felt nervous. I've been really... So I think it's just really grounding. And of course, like, my grandmother's always with me. Like, I tell Anne that all the time, you know? Like, so that is just part of my thinking. Like, it's just part of me being, right? Yeah, I do actively call on them if I need to, or before I'm doing a tattoo, for example.
Right. Yeah, describe for me, what is the tattoo process that you've been in?
I was taught by Milo Lefort, who is an amazing human being. I love him. It's been really cool. Like, the real reason I wanted to do it is so I could offer it at the shelter or to just to Indigenous folks in general, and they don't have to pay. But if I do for settlers, I'd like them to kind of donate something at least, right? But it's so been good.
Is it like a ceremonial process for you?
Like, yeah,
you
say it's kind of like medicine.
Like,
yeah.
How is it medicine?
Certainly recalling, you know, some old practices that used to happen, right? So, and I think a lot about like Cree women's tattoos. And I've done some research and watched, you know, like Skindigenous and read Dion Kazaz's PhD dissertation.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah.
Looking at all these amazing traditional tattoo artists that have a lot of their stuff online on Instagram and things like that. And then following the revival at traditional Inuit tattooing and then actually doing some for like Indigenous friends and non-Indigenous friends too. And then I do it on myself, of course. And I just find it super healing.
Yeah.
It's really not at all like the machine. It's just so much more quiet and personal and intimate, you know, and takes more time. But I think that's kind of the beauty of it, right?
Amazing.
Yeah.
I feel like that's... That's quite a bit of conversation that we've had here. Still, nice.
That's all, folks.
Yes.
Good night and good luck.
Now we get to go eat.
Oh my God, ossobuco. I made ossobuco. Oh, cooking. I love to cook.
Oh, good.
So, yeah, you're about to experience some of that.
I'm very happy that you love to cook.
Yeah, you're going to be really, really happy.
Yay. Well, thank you so Mo. Much for sharing.
Yeah. Hi.